Hi, I'm Natalie Gochner. This is Both Sides of the Aisle. I represent the political center and have on the political right, John Dougal.
Hey, always great to be with you.
Great to be with you, John, in studio and also in studio with us on the political left, Shireen Gourbani.
Hello and hi, listeners. Hope you're doing well.
Shireen and John, I need to get some quick takes on the presidential election heating up. We're having, it seems like every week there's two more candidates.
Everybody in the pool. Everybody jump on in.
Chris Christie jumping in. Your former home state, is it Doug Burgum?
Burgum. Yeah.
North Dakota governor, a software, you know, entrepreneur that's jumped in. What's your quick take, Shireen?
Again, I feel like we're headed towards a situation that is going to be a replay of 2016. Too many people in the race.
And
meaning,
yours, John?
Trump comes out on top. That's what you're saying.
That's what I'm saying.
John,
yeah, well, it's interesting. I mean, Chris Christie's known as a brawler and stuff like that. It's interesting to see the dynamics. He didn't get the traction in 2016, but we'll have to see what happens here. I know some are wondering, is he really in it to run to win as president, which he says he is, or is he in there just to attack Trump?
Mm-hmm.
And he's a brawler, so.
We're going to take an upcoming show and focus completely the whole time on the presidential election and just kind of what we're seeing in this election season. But I might be different than the two of you. I'm all for these Republican candidates getting in. I think that Trump will dissipate. I think DeSantis will dissipate. And I think the Republican Party will get to a more reasonable place. So. Ambitious.
Well, I hope you're right.
Hope springs eternal, right?
Especially for Utah Democrats.
Yeah. John, the Supreme Court has this sort of pattern to their work. And come June, they're wrapping up a lot of their decisions, a lot of things coming out. Explain to our listeners how this works. It took me a while to realize this. I didn't realize that there was like this big seasonality in the Supreme Court, but there is.
Well, so it's kind of the dynamic where it starts off in October, mm-hmm. and they start hearing all these cases, and then they sprinkle out some opinions through the year, but it really comes crashing down in May and June as they wrap up their session and they get it all out. And I kind of laugh a little bit when I was in the legislature, people would ask, why are all the big decisions decided at the end? And I said, it's because we can't put them off any later.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a little bit the dynamic
for
the Supreme Court. You're jockeying, you've got the hard decisions, you're trying to piece together, you know, majority opinions and seeing where people will agree and disagree and write those. And so, yeah, over the next few weeks, you're going to see lots of opinions coming out.
Okay.
And we've seen some over the last couple of weeks.
Just a couple of them. One is the Supreme Court had an 8-1 ruling with an opinion authored by Justice Amy Coney Barrett about giving employers the right to sue
people
who strike.
So this was an interesting dynamic. What had happened was these workers showed up. The cement was prepared. The cement was loaded into the trucks, and then they did their strike.
Teamsters right? Union, a
and
big
so,
union.
So they knew exactly what they were doing, and it looks like it was designed to destroy the equipment because the cement would solidify and destroy the trucks. And so the Supreme Court, 8-1, said, no, Washington State Supreme Court was wrong. The company does have the ability to sue the labor union over that kind of strike. Because they thought that was improper. And it was interesting. It was 8-1. And the one was Ketanji Brown Jackson. And she was of the opinion it needed to stay with the NLRB for them to adjudicate first before the Supreme Court weighed in.
Yeah. Shireen, anything on that?
I would just say that I think this, Supreme Court is certainly displaying a pattern of anti-worker and, certainly, I would say, anti-choice behavior. It's concerning, but I do think this is a unique situation where we're talking about the specific destruction of the equipment. I can understand this one. I just worry that it's part of a bigger pattern.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
There was another one, Sackett versus EPA, that came out, I think it was a week ago. And this was a 9-0 ruling in favor of the Sacketts.
Is that pretty unusual, 9-0?
Depending on the situation, I would say, yeah, it's kind of unusual here. What you really heard in the press was it was 5-4. It was 9-0 in favor of the Sacketts. It was 5-4 about what limits should be placed on the EPA as a result. This was a family mm-hmm. who had bought some property to build a home on near a lake, okay? And it was determined by the EPA that they couldn't and all sorts of other restrictions. And they sued. And this has run up to the Supreme Court in multiple times to get rulings on different aspects. But basically what the majority said is the EPA is overreading and they're overly broad in their interpretation of what are the waters of the United States. This isn't just navigable waters or those in close proximity, but it's, could be any water, any mud puddle, any whatever.
How about that lake where the Sears used to be?
It's a big one. We're talking State Street and what, about 8th South or
yeah,
something?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Maybe it's 9th
South. Does that count? It's a body of water?
Navigable. Maybe according to the EPA.
That's what we're saying.
Yeah, so.
Thanks for updating us on that, John. I just think listeners might find this interesting. When I worked at the EPA, just because I went there with the administrator and was a right-hand person, I ended up being in the senior meetings when a lot of the Supreme Court lawsuits were coming to bear. And it was such a fascinating thing. What I found is that the EPA has more brought before the Supreme Court than any other federal agency. It's because it's a regulatory agency. And one of my great regrets from my time in Washington is that I didn't go sit on the front row during one of our defenses, because the EPA has a lot. And talk about a legal team that's incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah, but they don't always win. Hey, Shireen, let's go to you and just talk for a minute about we've got, this change in our congressional makeup afoot. Congressman Stewart being now more firm about his intent to resign. And all of this talk about how do you do this. It looks like Governor Cox is going to call a special session.
Yeah, so there are real concerns. I think so we determined on the last show and with information.
If you haven't heard
if you haven't
go to our
heard
podcast, re-listen.
It can explain to you exactly what the process is, but the process is quite lengthy. Mm-hmm. So when the individual declares that they are stepping away from the House of Representatives, then there are 7 days in which the governor will call a special election. And I believe that they have to do a primary, and that's like a 90-day period. And then there's another 90-day period, which really puts this on a long timeline.
Basically, the current timeline would be something like March 5th.
So it is really, I do think we want people to be able to access their ballots. We understand that there is a need to send ballots potentially, well, I mean, always overseas, individuals who may be overseas who want to vote. So understanding what is the appropriate timeline for that to occur, I think it's possible 90 days is too long.
Mm-hmm.
So I believe the special session will look at shortening that timeline.
Mm-hmm. What do you predict?
And a March 5th would be an extra cost of an election. So you're talking probably $1 to $3 million for something like that. And so I think what they're looking at is how do we pull in the timeline? How do we lay on top of existing? Right now we've got municipal elections this year. We've got a primary scheduled August 15th, I believe, and then a general election at the beginning of November. How do we piggyback on those? Because then that also reduces the cost.
Yeah. Some easy principles here, meaning, you know, get it so that you're on August and November elections and shorten the timeline so that that can happen.
But one of the dynamics is, you know, when's the soonest the legislature could come in for a special session? Probably mid next week.
Mm-hmm.
And then you look and say, well, you got to have a convention before you have the primary, before you have, you know, and so there's all these different.
That
and I think the federal government requires at least 45 days in there for the Military Voter Act to send the ballots overseas.
Meanwhile, you have all these people, both Republicans and Democrats, watching this, evaluating whether they want to put their name out. And I predict the field will get pretty large pretty fast.
I think that's right. Well, and Becky Edwards did announce.
Yeah.
And this is not an easy process, is it, Shireen?
No, but it's a very rewarding process, and I do wish everyone the best and really encourage people to spend time on doorsteps with individuals talking about what Utahns are facing.
We all got a lot of fatigue talking about debt ceiling.
Yeah.
And I don't want to add to that fatigue, but let's just talk for a minute about how our congressional delegation voted on the debt ceiling bill. All four of Utah's Republican congressmen voted in favor of what's called the Fiscal Responsibility Act. Senator Lee voted against the bill. And Senator Romney voted in favor. So of our six, we got 5 out of 6, right?
Yeah. Get this right? What do you think of that, Natalie?
Oh, I think Senator Lee was misinformed on this. Yeah, I think it should have been a unanimous. I don't think it should have gotten this far. I'm super happy that my representative, Burgess Owens, because I worried there that he would not support it. But this was exactly what it – I mean, other than the fact they pushed it too long, this is what compromise is about. And when I read the compromise – this would be interesting to ask each of you. I'll go to John first. Who got the bigger size of the loaf?
I think Biden got the bigger size of the loaf.
I do too. What do you think?
Yes,
but he's in the strong position in the negotiation. And it is a negotiation. He didn't get everything he wanted – but yes.
I love the magazine The Week, and I am a dedicated reader. And they have on the cover a loaf, and it's cut. And I noticed that McCarthy's was smaller than Biden's. And so apparently editorially they think that too.
Yeah. I mean, I think it checks out. But I agree with you that I'm grateful I don't think that we're in a moment yet where compromise or coming together is deeply valued in the American body politic, but that's what this was. And I do think that's good for us.
Mm-hmm. I think there was a big win for McCarthy because, one, it was whether he could actually get a deal done, whether he could hold the House together, whether he could keep his seat in the process, whether he could get Biden to compromise at all. So to a certain extent, there were several wins for McCarthy in this process. Mm-hmm. Now, I think I'll disagree with you. I don't think Senator Lee was misinformed. I think Senator Lee wanted a better deal than what they got. Mm-hmm. And so he was coming from the perspective of, I'm voting no because it should have, could have been more. But to
very
your point
on
of
brand for him.
What's that?
It's very on brand for him. He's always voting no because of some fictional bill that doesn't exist. Like, I think you have to vote on what you have in front of you.
But to compromise, this is one of those dynamics. I mean, right. I always tell folks, compromise isn't necessarily bad. If compromise takes you in the direction you're trying to go, but maybe not as quickly, compromise can be okay.
I believe he did not like a portion of this bill that would presumably give too much power to OMB to override the PAYGO provisions or something. But the reason I say misinformed is, you know, how should we feel as constituents that on the major issues of our time, our senators completely override each other? It's like not having representation. And I don't know the dynamics of that, but to me—
To give you the scenario, it's either you're saying Senator Lee voted the wrong way or Senator Romney sold out
on
a poor deal.
Get in a room and talk about the major issues of our day and, you know, work through it and figure out how to be effective so that you don't always cancel each other out. And in this case, I think Senator Lee would have been correct to support on economic grounds. We can't get to default. You know, it's convenient to take this ideological position and not do it because the votes are going to be there to carry it. But in the end, I'm like, you know, who wants to work with someone that never compromises, that doesn't come with the party, that doesn't go with the flow?
Well, so he does compromise. I mean, your complaint's on this bill, but he's compromised and he's got some other things done on other bills. I would describe that I was one that voted no more than other people in the House when I served there.
Mm-hmm.
But I saw one of my jobs to be kind of the tip of the spear to drive certain change mm-hmm. to, and several years later, things came along in that direction. But I had to kind of break the ice and push in a certain direction. You know, when it came to pension reform in Utah, okay, part of my job was to say, this is unreasonable. It should be more, which, if you will, gave political cover to others and my colleagues to vote yes on the deal, which wasn't what I wanted, but it was a significant step in a better direction to fix our pension system.
Shereen, this is legislative strategy, legislative sausage making that John's describing there. And right. I get it. I think Senator Lee is a very wise, experienced guy. And he does some really good things. But when it comes with the creditworthiness of the United States of America, go with your president, go with your junior senator on this one. Well, we better take a quick break. Natalie Gochner with Shereen Ghorbani and John Dougal. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on KCPW. To hear all our in-house programs, you can go to the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider donating to keep public radio alive on KCPW.
Shereen Ghorbani on the left.
John Dougal on the right.
Natalie Gochner in the Political Center. This is Both Sides of the Aisle, and I am so excited to talk about this issue because it has so much sort of drama and fun to it in some ways, and then also it's pretty serious public policy. But this banning of the Bible and considering banning of the Book of Mormon in the Davis County School District or in the Davis School District, I was watching CNN the other night while I'm cooking dinner, and all of a sudden they started talking about the Book of Mormon being banned, you know, from public schools in Utah, and I'm just like, oh no, where is this going to go? And then they moved really on to the Bible and they didn't, but it had the potential to really flare, you know, and talk about the contents of the Book of Mormon. I'm like, I don't know if this is the right thing, you know, to be doing. But, you know, Senator Todd Weiler's an active listener, you know, just a terrific guy. I think that he carried this bill. Am I correct?
Oh, so
I've heard him comment a lot on it.
He's commented on it, but I actually think it was Representative Ivory.
Okay. All right.
And Senator Weiler lives up in Davis County, so he's right there.
Right in the thick of it.
Yeah.
My point would be that I don't think they intended this to happen.
Yeah, no kidding.
So this is the fun, dramatic part of it.
So
have you read part of the Bible?
Yeah.
That's Songs of Solomon's. A little racy there.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, a question I have, is the Book of Mormon as sexy as the Bible? I don't know. You could tell me. So here's what I would
get you a copy.
So here's what I think is interesting. Initially, Representative Ivory said that, you know, the people who are calling for the removal of the Bible are kind of making a mockery of what the law was intended to do, and then had to come out and say, no, in fact, I think that this is appropriate because these are the rules that we've created. And in fact, there are some rather racy adult content happening in the Bible that may not be appropriate. So I want to be very clear. I do not think that we should be banning books in schools. I think that it is very reasonable to trust librarians and schools to put books in classrooms, in libraries, and that if you have a child like I do, an 8-year-old, that kid picks up a book and he reads what he's interested in and he doesn't read what he's not interested in. And I am very actively involved in the conversations about what he spends his time reading, which is why I can tell you a lot about sharks. But I do think that there's
sharks
are awesome, but I mean, you know, sometimes they're they could potentially be controversial, I guess, if there's a story about a little gay shark. Let's be honest, here's what's happening. So I think,
how about whales? I know there's whales in the Bible.
Well, there you go. But I just think that this is an unbelievably you know, anti-intellectual and fundamentally just a real fraying again of our trust in institutions, trusting professionals who can guide people through. And truly, given the reading skills that our kids have in this country broadly, I think we should all be thrilled when people are picking up a book. So, and having difficult conversations about what that book brings up. But my experience has been something is over my kid's head, something that's not really his thing. He's not reading it. And the majority of these books that have been pulled by a very small group of families that consistently are utilizing this process. My understanding is the Salt Lake District has not had any books requested for review, that this is really happening in Davis County and a few other places.
Shireen's asked him to actually get some more books.
Get some more books in there, some more sexy Bible books. I just feel like it's concerning, and I don't think it's a good sign for the health of our communities.
John, what do you think about this point of this being anti-intellectual? I mean,
how so?
Well,
how so?
Intellectual's an interesting thing to be saying for, you know, grade school kids. But what if we just said, what is it that we want to shield our kids from? You know, because I feel like too often we shield them from life and assume that parents don't have a lot of involvement in helping to interpret and shape the way they think through life.
Yeah. So I think there's a couple things there. I mean, I think we should all step back and say there is certain content that I would hope we would all agree that for, let's say, 6-year-olds, it's not appropriate for them to watch or read or whatever it might be. It's just step back.
And let's step back and agree that there are professionals that are typically curating educational experiences in public libraries, in school libraries. That also happens.
And so we have a process whereby folks select. Now, whether that's banning or not banning, what we want to call it, there is a certain set of folks, professionals, that are making decisions here. Now, I think many of them probably do a fantastic job, but there's probably some that probably push the envelope and create certain discussion or certain concern with certain books that are in the library. And how do we deal with that? And sometimes parents are involved and know, and sometimes parents don't. I do remember when I was in eighth grade, I was assigned the book To Kill a Mockingbird. And my mom had not read the book, and all she read was the little blurb, the little paragraph on the back of the book. And all of a sudden that set off concerns for her because she's just seeing this thing that's supposed to, you know, animate folks to read the book on a topic that caused her some concern. Now, it was a fine book and stuff like that. But that's where I think there's some concern of to what extent are parents involved or not involved in understanding what kind of material is being presented to their kids.
I this is the wisdom I would share. Be careful what you spend time on. And so my husband is a bright man. And one time on an issue like this, he made the comment that the bad gets worse and the good gets confused. So just think about this.
So what does that mean to you?
Well, what that means to me is that we're spending all this time on things that we think are good, but we're just confused. We're just doing confusing things. And we should spend more time on promoting good. The good's getting confused while the bad gets worse. And in my husband's context, it was this idea of in a Sunday school setting, in a church setting, you can only, you know, teach from things that you can buy at Deseret Book. Imagine that. right? Cutting out Walt Whitman and, you know, Emerson and Thoreau. I mean, transcendental literature. I mean, these are some beautiful things that you can bring into a church context.
J.R.R. Tolkien.
Sure. And just this,
C.S. Lewis.
This idea that why would you ever let bad keep doing where it's going and then confuse good? And so to me, this is one of those examples where I'm like, man, we're getting the good confused if we're not allowing in a public place to have a holy writ.
Now, if I recall right, it was Abraham Lincoln that said something along these lines, and I think Shireen would appreciate this. The best way to overturn a bad law is to strictly enforce it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, a lot more to come on that. Let's talk about the UTA bus.
Okay.
Shireen, I can't help but ask you to set this one up.
All right. So in previous
We're
years—
waiting at the bus stop.
And including this year, there's a UTA bus that has a very colorful pride message. It's got rainbows on it. It's got all the flags represented. And I do believe it says ride with pride and work with pride. So it's also a recruiting tool, okay? And it appears in the Pride Parade. It's super fun. And some legislators got real worried about it and started sending personal text messages to members of the UTA board and other individuals in the organization saying, this is not appropriate, not how taxpayer dollars should be spent. But then I think they went further. Well, I know they went further because now we're seeing text messages coming out where leaders in our legislature are saying things like, we shouldn't have to deal with this stuff. Mm-hmm. We're also seeing the governor put out his Pride Month, you know, declaration and removed the actual phrase LGBTQ+, and basically just said, it's Pride Month, declaring Pride Month, acknowledging it, but removing it. I think both of these are felt as a sense of erasure. And this idea of having to step back, and I want to be really clear, especially on the bus wrap, so the what you see on the bus was provided by a donor. This was a donor-funded wrap on the bus, so not taxpayer dollars. Certainly it's something that appears publicly, but I guess the questions that this raises for me is, one, I would ask all of us to be thinking very seriously about the way in which we dehumanize others in our community because we don't necessarily identify or like what we're seeing. But when you say we shouldn't have to deal with this stuff, that is a person. That is a person I love. That's me. That's my family. You know what I mean? Like, that's us.
Right.
So
you're a mistake.
Yeah, it's not.
I'm better.
Mm-hmm. That's not the message we need. And really, I have to say, I marched in the Pride Parade with Project Rainbow in front of a giant sign that said, "No, you are loved." And my favorite thing to do in the Pride Parade is to just ride the streets and scream at people, "I love you." Mm-hmm. And that is the message of pride to me. And I think that these messages are, again, part of a very scary movement that we're seeing to dehumanize and further marginalize people who just want to love who they love.
John, that was a pretty, you know, well-articulated point of view.
Yeah, unfortunately, part of the dynamic here is, you know, this is a government piece of property. And the question is, and this is the debate we have all throughout different activities, but I'll compare it here, is government is speaking on behalf of all the citizens. Mm-hmm. Okay. Are they engaging in something that we agree with, we disagree with? Let's suppose it was saying, you know, we're going to have a bus that says, go oil. We're going to have a bunch of folks that are going to be upset about that. And so the simple fact is, you know, we've got this broader dynamic, which is when government speaks, what is the form in which it should speak? Now, I come from the perspective of I think government speaks way too often on different things, and it should be left to private citizens to speak on what they believe and what they favor or disagree with, and let the private citizens engage in that dialogue.
I just really would like to invite people with me on a journey where we consider that if I am married to a woman, that that's not an act of politics. That is an act of love. Okay, so when we say, is the government speaking on oil or gas or whatever, I do think it's different than the fundamental fabric of who makes up what I identify as and what makes up my life. Like, they just are a little bit different.
Mm-hmm. I don't think we've heard the end of this.
No.
Just my guess, right? And particularly in the Governor Cox world, do you expect the governor to be in a leadership role here on how our state's portrayed, represented, shared? He's shown proclivities to be very thoughtful and welcoming of the LGBTQ family. And yet, dropped it out of his
statement.
His statement. Yeah. And so I
it is re-election time next year.
Yeah.
And that's how these things go.
Yeah. The thing to me on the public bus side, you know, there's a lot of things on UTA buses that I don't like, even though it's public property. You know, personal injury lawyer, advertisements, different things. I mean, but in this case, you're actually saying we care about you.
Can you imagine?
You know, it just seems
we will
like
probably have debates about advertising on buses
and more
in
to
the
come.
Years to come.
Yeah. Well, what an interesting discussion with both of you. I thank you for your friendship. And Shireen Gorbani, Natalie Gochner, John Dougal. The program is produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks, everybody, for listening.